Gallup. I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is the Gallup Podcast. In this episode, as we mark a year since the coronavirus pandemic struck the world, we dig into a timely book which lays out the lessons learned from the crisis and how it's likely to change our world into the future. Fareed Zakaria is a man who needs little introduction. Since 2008, he's hosted Fareed Zakaria GPS for CNN Worldwide. He's also a columnist for the Washington Post, as well as a contributing editor for The Atlantic and a best-selling author. In his latest book, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World, he breaks down with brilliance how this pandemic is likely to reshape the world we're living in. Fareed, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Muhammad, it's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
As usual, you had an awesome headline that really says it all, what the book was about. But let me ask you, what was it like to write this book, and who did you have in mind when you wrote it?
Well, it came about not in any kind of planned fashion. So the pandemic hits, as you recall, and we are all stuck wherever we were. And I found myself with a lot of time on my hands. All my travel had been canceled. Every lunch, every dinner. And so I started to jot down what I thought were the major trends that were coming out of this pandemic, really as a way to help me understand it, as a way to help me for the show, for the Washington Post column, for, you know, just my own kind of internal education. And then a few days later, this is now March, when everything is shut down, I realized that I had something here. And I called up my publisher and I said, you know, what would you think of a book really that tried to help people understand what this pandemic was going to do to all of us? And I started to, after that, what I would do is I'd get up at about 6 in the morning, 6:30, and I wouldn't read any newspapers. I wouldn't look at Twitter. I wouldn't do, you know, nothing that was immediate, nothing that was the news of the moment. And I would just sit and write and research and read, occasionally call an expert or two, but really try to help myself figure it out by staying focused on that sort of the longer term horizon. And I'd do that till about 11. And then I would, you know, I had my day job. So then I would get back to work on the show, the column. My kids were all there, so making breakfast, that kind of thing. It worked very well because I was more motivated than I can recall with a book ever, partly because I knew I kind of had to get it out fast, partly because it was helping me understand what was happening. So it was a kind of a catharsis for me. And I did what I described, 6 to about 10:30, 6:30 to 11, every day for 4.5 months. And that's the book.
Wow, that's fascinating. You start the book by taking a broad look at sort of major events in our lifetime. I love how you compared 9/11, the Great Recession of 2008, and the COVID pandemic, and how each changed our world, but started with a relatively small actor. Reflect on that for us. I thought it was really interesting.
Well, you know, what I'm struck by is we're all trying to understand, even now, right, what is the next big crisis? And when we think about that, we ask ourselves, well, what's the big stuff out there that is going to have a huge impact on us? You know, the Chinese army is going to attack us, or the Russian Air Force, or the missiles that come from their nuclear bases are going to attack us. Those are the kind of big threats we imagine. But if you look back at 9/11, the global financial crisis, and the pandemic, what's striking is it's actually asymmetrical threats. It's things that start out small, but then snowball. Those are the ones that are, in a sense, it makes perfect sense that these are the ones that we don't see coming, because it's the something that was small that became big rather than something that's big to start. If it's big to start, you're looking at it. If it's small, you're neglecting it. So 9/11, of course, is 19 people with small knives, box cutters, that board a few commercial aircraft. And then it turns into this grand clash of civilizations. The global financial crisis starts with something so obscure, most finance people didn't know it. I remember this when I would ask them about it when it first started to happen. you know, the credit default swap, which is a kind of bet on an insurance plan for a mortgage. And this thing turns out to have unraveled the entire global financial system. With the pandemic, of course, it's even smaller. It's a virus, right? It's a microscopic particle that was probably in the saliva of a bat somewhere in China, somewhere in Wuhan or in Hubei province in China. And yet all these things turn out to have these huge impacts. And it's partly a way of thinking about what we should be worried about in life and to recognize that the nature of the world we're living in, it's so fast moving, so connected, so dynamic, that it's often the small thing that snowballs rather than the big obvious threat to worry about.
In the book, you say, and I quote, "The world is open, fast, and unstable." You began to sort of describe that just right now. How do successful societies, or let's say successful democracies, manage those variables?
Yeah, first of all, it's a good thing, you know, in a way that we created this very open, dynamic, resourceful, connected world. You know, this is really the world we created. When I say we created, that emerged. But in some sense, the United States had a very powerful shaping role. This is the world that emerged after the collapse of communism, right? When basically all of the world moves into one global system, political, economic. Everyone is suddenly trading with one another. Everyone is investing in one another. Money is flowing across the world. Ideas are flowing. You know, we go from the world of division between the communist world and the non-communist world to one where everyone is sort of part of the same system, which has allowed for enormous dynamism, enormous innovation, the creation of these extraordinary technology companies and information platforms that span the globe. But it's also created an enormous amount of volatility. And you can see it just by thinking about, since that world has been created, think about all the crises we've had. I mean, we don't think back, you know, that way, but, you know, it's you had the Mexican crisis, the East Asian crisis, the Russian crisis, which was the Russian default, which was caused the long-term capital crisis, which, you know, then you had the tech bubble bursting, then you had the housing bubble bursting, then you had the credit default swap, and then not to mention the many political crises that also are happening at the same time, the crisis in Yugoslavia, 9/11, of course, and now this pandemic. So if you put it all together, this is just 30 years, and it's been pretty action-packed. And the reason is you can't have an open, connected, dynamic system that is also highly stable. You can have a lot of growth and dynamism, but then often you have to close it off the way the Chinese do to maintain a stable system. But to have everything open, everything dynamic, just inevitably means it's just moving so fast, you can't control it. And I think for a democracy, the answer is, and I try to sort of, this is in a sense the meta lesson, we have to realize you have to buy insurance. Or another way of putting it is you have to stabilize the system a bit. Not even the system. You have to create greater resilience for yourself. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. You know, the metaphor I use is we're driving a fast race car through unmarked terrain, and we haven't bothered to put in seatbelts or airbags or to buy car insurance. You know, we're just driving faster and faster. Well, maybe we need to do those things. You know, maybe we need to think not just about dynamism, but a little bit more about resilience. And it's something I think that applies to countries. It applies to companies. It applies to individuals. You know, how do we make ourselves psychologically resilient through these kind of ups and downs? Because guess what? The next 30 years are likely to be as volatile as the last 30.
You dig a bit into the state of free market capitalism and the apparent renewed appeal to some of socialism. Talk to us about what you discovered, because at one point in the book, you kind of say the answer really is in how you define socialism. And it struck me because that's exactly what we found in our work in trying to understand, particularly in the US, what do Americans mean by socialism? And it's increasingly this definition of more social equity less so the definition of government controlling the means of production. Talk to us about what you found when you looked into socialism's appeal.
Yeah, you have it exactly right, Mohammed. I think that you know what's happened is when intellectuals talk about socialism or elites talk about socialism, particularly people over 40 or 45, they are referring to a kind of Cold War debate about which was the better system, capitalism or socialism, in the context of the Cold War, in the context of the struggle between communism and the free world. That's not how most people mean it today. That's certainly not how most young people mean it. What they're trying to figure out is, how can we get a system that is both productive and dynamic, but is also has a lot of equity and fairness, and you know that is compassionate. And so, in a sense, one way to think about it is, you know, in a sense, there is no that prior debate is over. Capitalism won. The Soviet Union collapsed. The question we're now asking is, what form of capitalism do we want? And what people are increasingly gravitating toward is a form of capitalism that I think has been perfected, well, maybe not perfected, but has achieved great results in Northern Europe. And that's basically to say, let's keep capitalism, let's embrace capitalism, let's have all the dynamism and vigor and wealth production that produces, but then let's do a fair amount of redistribution, mainly to provide everybody with with equality of opportunity, so that, you know, because that's something everyone can agree on. And that is where, frankly, we are moving in this country as well. And if you look at this Biden bill of $1.9 trillion, a lot of it goes toward that kind of equity, equality of opportunity. So the focus is often on childcare, on nutrition, on making sure that everyone has equal access to a decent education. Because that's what I think people are much more comfortable with. And that's what place like Denmark has really achieved with extraordinary success, so that, you know, by many measures, Denmark is more free market than the United States. In fact, the Heritage Foundation has an index of economic freedom. The Heritage is a very conservative foundation, and Denmark scores higher than the United States does, because it has low taxes, low regulations, low tariffs. I should say it differently. They have low tariffs, low regulations. But once they generate the wealth, they do have high taxes, and they use that money to create the best cradle-to-grave system of opportunity, you know, so that you're given, there's a lot of investment made in you, healthcare and education and such, but then companies can hire and fire very easily in Denmark, you know, so that's an interesting model. And I think that's what people mean when they say they want socialism. It's funny, Bernie Sanders often says he wants America to look more like Denmark. I think he's not as aware of how free market Denmark is, but it's the combination that makes for the magic, which is dynamism plus a certain amount of social protections.
Absolutely. And it was really interesting for me to read that in the book, how the leadership in Denmark sort of had to correct the record and say, this is the way we like to describe our own system. And
that's the Prime Minister of Denmark said, after Bernie Sanders kept praising it as a socialist country, he said, we need to explain, we do not have a socialist economy. We have a free market economy. We do redistribute in order to provide people with opportunities.
And that is a really important distinction, I think, especially when you think about employment. I mean, one of the hallmarks of the U.S. system is this very cutthroat at-will employment system that's very different than what you see in Europe. What you describe in Denmark in your book is interesting. It's sort of a hybrid where the employer has a lot of freedom to make decisions based on the business judgment rule, as we call it here in the US, but the system still has a net for those that end up on the unfortunate side of that judgment and lose their job and court sort of get support for retraining, et cetera.
Yeah, you point to the most extraordinary piece of the Danish system, which is exactly right. So labor participation in Denmark is higher than in the United States. Now, that's a kind of wonky term, but what that means is people keep looking for jobs and participating in the labor market in Denmark. Now, why is that important? Because Denmark has a very generous safety net. And the whole thesis in America is, if your safety net is too generous, if your welfare system is too generous, if your unemployment insurance is too generous, people will not have an incentive to work. People will not have an incentive to go and search for work. But Danes, with an even more generous system than the US, are searching for work more than in the US. So why is that? Well, it's what you were saying, which is the Danish system prioritizes retraining, prioritizes, you know, you have to show up at the unemployment office. You have to explain that you've been searching for work. You have to, if they suggest that you get retraining, you have to take it. And if you don't, you lose your, you know, in other words, the system is geared toward making sure that you are searching. But while you're doing it, they don't believe there's any point in your living in abject poverty and starving, because that, by the way, that also has huge follow-on health consequences for society as a whole. You get unhealthy, you get sick, you have to go to hospitals. You know, it's a very intelligent thing. So, for example, one of the greatest investments this Biden bill has is the child benefit that it's about $300 for each kid per month, I think. The estimate is it'll cut childhood poverty in America by half. Now, that is going to have, that'll pay for itself, because, you know, unhealthy children, poor children, malnourished children end up being less productive. They make less money. They're more likely to end up in jail. So they cost society a lot at the back end. And if you just, the $300 per month at the front end is actually a very small investment, that'll have a huge payoff. Denmark does a lot of that kind of early upfront investing.
Your third lesson in the book is, quote, what matters most is not the quantity of government, but the quality. The failures of the U.S. system, Fareed, particularly in reaction to COVID, are now really obvious. You say some powerful things in the book about American exceptionalism, whether the concept is real, an illusion. I just want to ask you, does American exceptionalism, in your view, need to be redefined, or is it better to retire it to the realm of mythology?
It's a very good question, Mohammed. I think the way I would put it, as an immigrant, I think there is a very powerful reality to American exceptionalism. I think that there's a reason I'm in America. There's a reason you're in America. There is a reason a million people come to America legally every year. But I think that that exceptionalism is about a, you know, it's about a certain core set of things that America is about. It's a country that is founded on an idea, not bloodlines and birth. It allows anyone from anywhere to come in and participate and to be an American. That's an incredibly powerful thing, and it is exceptional. But it doesn't mean we have the best of everything in, you know, in every governmental institution. Our economic arrangements are perfect, our, you know, our societal arrangement. I think that's what the mistake has been, to mistake the idea that America is exceptional for the reasons that Abraham Lincoln described in the Gettysburg Address, as a nation dedicated to a proposition that all men are created equal. Doesn't mean we have the best healthcare system in the world. It doesn't mean we have the best welfare system in the world. It doesn't mean we have the best infrastructure in the world. In fact, it's patently obvious we don't. So I think that's the mistake. It's the spillover. And that, you know, and part of it is, I think, the victory in the Cold War and things like that have led Americans to believe that we're number one at everything. Whereas, in fact, the reality is we're very much not number one in lots of these areas. Many of them we never were. And it has, that kind of mentality has inhibited us from doing what any good business does when it confronts any problem in the world, which is to ask, who's doing this better and how can I learn from them? We don't benchmark to best practices in this country very much. And that is, I think, one of the sad consequences of that kind of exaggerated view of American exceptionalism.
You know, it's funny when you cited some of Arthur Brooks's work. He's a Gallup senior scientist. And when he was on the podcast, it was kind of the height of the pandemic. And I asked him, you know, does American exceptionalism, is it real? Does it exist? And he very cleverly turned the tables on me and asked me if I felt it was real. And I said, I started exactly with what you said, Fareed. I said, as an immigrant, I mean, it's not fair to ask me. I think the real question is, why are so many more of us as Americans, born here, not born here, whatever, not able to sort of achieve that American dream? That, you know, I'm 40 years old. In the 90s, it was unequivocal that America was number one. America was exceptional. It was easy to say that because so many of the benefits of what had happened after the Cold War were very obvious. But now in this, you know, world of ever-changing dynamics, it really is also easier to see the flaws in the system. I want to ask you about this concept of two Americas. You really nailed it in one of the chapters where you say America's sort of become like the sports stadium, and you analogize how America is today to how it used to be compared to how a sports stadium used to be and how it is now. Could you take us through that analogy?
Sure. So I think we're all aware that there's enormous inequalities that have built up, and these inequalities have gotten worse. And one of the things that I think it's important to understand is that they're becoming not just economic changes, but these are divisions, but these are cultural divisions, these are class divisions. You have, you know, one group of people, largely urban, college educated, professional, who often work with their minds, often in kind of ways that are digitally savvy. And there's another group of Americans who mostly live in the rural areas, mostly work with their hands rather than their head, mostly don't have college degrees or even diplomas of any kind. And that divide is causing great, enormous amounts of resentment. But we tend to think, oh, this is structural, we can't do anything about it, it's technology, it's globalization. But there's a lot we have done to cement that division, to create even greater aspects of that division. And what we have done is basically we have made it possible for money to buy almost everything in American society today. So there's a line in the movie Jerry Maguire where the woman is with her son and she's looking enviously and she's in a plane and she's in coach and she's looking enviously past the curtain up front. And he says to her, What are you doing, Mom? What are you looking at? And she says, that's first class, honey. It used to be a better meal. Now it's a better life. And I think that sort of captures it. Wow. You know, so the stadium metaphor I used was, you know, if you went to a baseball game in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, through the 1980s, actually, when I first came to America, rich or poor, you pretty much got the same seats. Certainly the quality of the seat physically was exactly the same. You largely got your placement on the field based on a first-come, first-serve basis. There's very little you could do to kind of ensure in advance that you had better seats, and very little you could do with money. The seats often cost, you know, in tiers, they cost roughly the same. And so it was very democratic. You know, people would show up and, you know, the people who got there first would have, and everyone was sitting, and everyone was out there. Everyone was eating from the same hot dog vendors and things like that. Now you go into a newly constructed sports stadium and you feel as though you're in some kind of 19th century Victorian, a caricature of class. There is the luxury skyboxes in which, you know, corporate CEOs have bought boxes for their companies in which you get, you know, Michelin star meals catered with, you know, premium wines and things. Then you have, you know, one tier below that, so is another level. Each one is called something different. You know, it's sort of like the way airlines do their tiered, you know, somebody's platinum, somebody's gold, somebody's silver, somebody's deluxe. And then you have the vast majority of people stuck in the bleachers. And I think it's a terrible sign of what's happened, because it really has become one of these things where you can really opt out if you are rich from normal American society. You can live in a gated community. You can use some kind of private form of transportation. There are even places where, you know, where there are public parks which provide for a fee some kind of private access. I think this is all terrible. Part of a democracy is there should be elements of the there should be public goods that are just freely open to the public, and that's it. You know, I mean, you should. I worry one day that I'll wake up and discover that Central Park has auctioned off, you know, jogging times so that the billionaires can jog at, you know, 7 a.m. before they go to work. And if you're a school teacher, the only time you can jog in Central Park is, you know, 1 p.m. or something like that.
In the morning.
Yeah, that's where we're headed. And that's what worries me.
When I just want to read this quote from the book because I loved it. You say, quote, if money can buy a house or a yacht, that's one thing. But if it can buy citizenship, special access to public spaces, preferential treatment at colleges, and favors from politicians, it becomes a corrupting and corroding force.
That's right. And, you know, we didn't talk about the first part of that, which is, this is the E5 visa program that one of the only areas of immigration that Donald Trump actually expanded, which is that rich people can buy not just a visa, but they can actually buy citizenship because that visa translates into a green card, which translates into citizenship. And it's for a remarkably small amount of money. I forget what it is, but it's a few million dollars of investment in America. You have to prove that you've hired one or two people and you become a citizen. And it seems to me it's so antithetical to the idea of America.
And in the book, you do a great job of explaining how this is really a global phenomenon. This is also happening in some European countries, particularly Southern European countries. But again, in traditional Fareed Zakaria optimism, you sort of move to this concept of reform, not revolution. Is it realistic? Let's just talk about in the U.S. Do you see a path to reform in this very hyper-partisan, sort of static national political environment?
So let me say why sort of fundamentally I'm optimistic. And you're absolutely right that I do end the book on a kind of note of optimism. And part of it is, look, I'm an immigrant by temperament. I tend to be optimistic. I came to this country. I feel as though, things... I have to believe in the future, otherwise what the hell did I, do coming here? But I do. but in this particular case, I do think that the pandemic has actually produced a great opportunity, which is things are already disrupted. Things are already upended. That's when you make changes. That's when you're willing to conceive of big changes. Nobody fixes the roof when the sun is shining. No, if you look at the history of economic reform in countries, particularly democracies, it only happens when there's crisis, when there's blood on the floor, when people feel like things are already, we've got some stuff that we have to deal with. There's disruption, there's dislocation already. So we are in that moment. And so I do think it's a moment where we have a lot of choice, we have agency, and we can make really important changes. Now, to your point, look, let's look at what's just happened. We just passed. I don't want to minimize, what's happened here. In my lifetime in the United States, the only fiscal measures of any significance that have taken place have been tax cuts. The Reagan tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts, the Trump tax cuts. This is a $1.9 trillion program, the vast majority of whose benefits will go to the poorest third of Americans. That is the first time it's happened since the Great Society in Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. So we've made a big change. This is really, this is a big deal. To quote Vice President Biden when Obamacare passed, this is a big effing deal. If we do infrastructure, that could be another extraordinary moment. But you're right, there is a limiting factor here, which is that we're deeply divided, we're polarized. The 22 election will have a lot to do with whether this process continues or whether it is stymied. But look, I'm hopeful because I think that at the end of the day, this bill is extraordinarily popular, even though Republicans didn't vote for it. I mean, 65% of the American people support it. And I think if you build on that kind of support, maybe you show people that there's a possibility here to really govern. The Republican Party has to figure out what it stands for. It used to stand for balanced budgets, tax cuts, fiscal discipline, all that kind of stuff. Trump has upended all that. What he stands for is cultural nationalism, tariffs, immigration restrictions, that kind of thing. Which is it? How are those things compatible? They haven't figured all that out. So I think that there's certainly we will not be able to achieve a kind of sustained era of reform without that getting sorted out. But I still am hopeful because I think that what people are seeing is the policies are popular, even if the party implementing them is not as, the Democrats are not as popular as the policies.
Fareed, I'm somebody who grew up learning, continue to be learning from you a lot about the U.S., and I've hogged all of our time here to talk about a lot about the U.S., but primarily in, on the global level. You are really unlike anyone in being able to really frame really complicated global situations in very basic terms that we can all kind of wrap our minds around. When you look at the broader global order, in chapter 9, you do a beautiful job of sort of explaining how things were already changing before the pandemic hit. You tackle the questions of whether the American model has sort of run its course. You mentioned, of course, deaths of despair. We talked about there being two Americas. But you also explain what you describe as a bipolar world now clearly coming into view. How can a bipolar order flourish while avoiding another all-out Cold War?
That is the central kind of question for, on the international scene. Because I was actually struck by how bipolar the world already is. I sort of thought to myself, this is something that, you know, you project forward. But the United States is, of course, number one. But China is already the number two economy in the world by far. And when I say by far, what I mean is China is larger than number three, four, five, and six put together. Military spending, US is, of course, number one. China is number two. And again, China is larger than number two, three, four, five, and six put together. So, you know, the definition of a bipolar system is often that the two top players are in a league of their own. They don't have to be equal. The U.S. is clearly much stronger than China, but the U.S. was much stronger than the Soviet Union. We still had the reality of dealing with a kind of bipolar order. So we're already in there, you know, kind of there. It's a very different world because everyone is much more powerful and active and connected. And that, you know, I talk a lot about in the book as well. But this central dynamic is going to be the defining geopolitical dynamic, which is how do the United States and China deal with one another? Look, at some level, I believe there's a lot of opportunity for win-win because, you know, if the United States and China can find ways to live together, it means a much bigger global economy, a much more connected global economy, much more trade, much more travel, much more tourism, much more investment, all of which helps everyone. You know, U.S. is only 4% of the world. The only way we're going to raise standards of living is if we can trade, invest, buy and sell with the other 96% on good terms, of course. But still, you need that. You need those markets. The danger is that Trump unlocked a very dark part of America, a very dark side of America that really believes the only way for us to win is for others to lose. The only way for us to succeed is for China to fail. The only way China is succeeding is by cheating, which is not true. China does cheat, by the way, so do we. But most of China's success is because of the hard work of the Chinese people, because they open themselves up to market economics, because they have low wages, because they have high savings rates, you know, all kinds of fairly traditional economic reasons. And so the question we face is, can we figure out a way to live in a world with another country, a very different civilization, that is, you know, in the same league as us? We haven't had to deal with this question for a long, long time. The United States is very comfortable either exiting the world or dominating the world. We don't like
hot or cold.
No, we don't like to deal with that in between where we have to engage with a world in which there are a lot of people who have voice and agency. So we either say the world is evil and we're going to exit. That was the pre-World War I strategy, or we say, we are going to dominate the world. That is the post-World War II strategy, which is how do we engage with a world in which there are a lot of countries that are powerful and rich and won't listen to, won't snap, won't jump when we snap our fingers. And principally that means China.
The book is called 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. Fareed Zakaria, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Mohammed. All best.
That's our podcast. Thank you for tuning in. To subscribe to the podcast from any podcast app, just search the Gallup Podcast. And for more key findings from Gallup News, go to news.gallup.com or follow us at Gallup News. If you have questions, feedback, or suggestions on topics for future episodes, we want to hear from you. Write to us directly by emailing podcast@gallup.com. This Gallup podcast is directed by Curtis Grubb and produced by Justin McCarthy. I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is Gallup, reporting on the will of the people since the 1930s.